If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
When Sweet Tarts dared to combine sweet and tart, they thought, why stop there? Why not create other exciting and unexpected combinations, like rainbows and ropes, or fruity and gummy, or chewy and more chewy? That's why they created fun treats like Sweet Tarts Twisted Rainbow Ropes, Gummies Fruity Splits, and Chewy Fusions. When you dare to combine, it's sure to blow your mind. Sweet Tarts, dare to combine. Visit SweetTartsCandy.com to shop now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
If you went on a road trip and you didn't stop for a Big Mac or drop a crispy fry between the car seats or use your McDonald's bag as a placemat, then that wasn't a road trip. It was just a really long drive. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At participating McDonald's.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
She was extremely powerful, feared, respected. She had a great empire of land and estates in the Midlands and the West Country. She was a businesswoman, she was a moneylender, and she was also a builder. And that's actually what interested me in particular, was the fact that she built.
That was Kate Hubbard describing one of the most powerful women of the Tudor age, Bess of Hardwick.
Listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. In today's episode, we'll be discovering the story of Bess of Hardwick, a woman who rose from relative obscurity to become one of the most influential figures of the Elizabethan age. Bess's life has been chronicled in a new biography by the author Kate Hubbard, and she spoke to our digital editorial assistant, Rachel Dinning.
So I'm in our London offices with Kate Hubbard to talk about her new book, Devices and Desires, Bess of Hardwick and the Building of Elizabethan England. So welcome, Kate, to the History Extra podcast.
Thank you.
Great to have you. So to start, could you perhaps tell us a bit about Bess of Hardwick? Who was she and why did you want to write a book about her?
Well, Bess of Hardwick was a Tudor woman born in 1521 or thereabouts, living 87 years. She died in 1608, so she had an extremely long life at the time. And she came from relatively humble beginnings in Derbyshire. She was born into a gentry family. She didn't have much in the way of education, but she forged a path sort of through Elizabethan England, partly via four husbands, each one grander and richer than the last. And so she ended up, when she died in 1608, she was a countess. She was the Dowager Countess of Shrewsbury, and she was immensely rich, second only to the Queen, second richest woman in England. Next to the Queen. She was extremely, she was powerful, feared, respected. She had a great empire of land and estates in the Midlands and the West Country. She was a businesswoman, she was a moneylender, and she was also a builder. And that's actually what interested me in particular, was the fact that she built four houses, of which only one, Hardwick Hall, is still standing. But I was interested in the fact that she was a woman building in 16th century England.
Was this particularly unusual to have a female builder, or were other women of, you know, who were higher up the social scale, were they doing this similar kind of thing to Bess?
No, I think she really was for the time. I think it was a great era of building in Tudor England. I mean, it was a time when there was money to be made, people made fortunes, members of the gentry became extremely rich through the dissolution and passed into the ranks of the aristocracy. And if you had money, if you made money, you built a house. That was a sort of visible expression of your wealth. But all the other builders, they were men. I mean, there were no other female builders at that time. So she was unique in that respect, in being a woman builder.
Mm-hmm. So you mention in the book that your interest in Bess began with her surviving house, so Hardwick Hall.
Yes.
So can you tell me perhaps when you first visited Hardwick Hall and where your interest in Bess and this building sort of began?
Well, I think I probably visited Hardwick Hall about 10 years ago. It's if you're driving along the M1, you see Hardwick Hall sort of sitting up above, looking down onto the M1. So you sort of know, you can't really miss it. And when I visited it, I was very struck by it, and particularly by the fact that the most noticeable feature, apart from its enormous windows for which it's famous, but the fact that all along the parapet of the house are these enormous letters, ES, Bess's initials. And that seemed rather extraordinary, that you would build a house and then sort of plaster your initials all over it on the outside, and actually all over the inside as well, in where ESs are carved into the plasterwork and embroidered on textiles. And then when I also discovered that, in fact, she'd started work on Hardwick when she was nearly 70, so she was elderly, and she already had several houses. She sort of didn't need a house. And it seemed at a time when you might have been sort of winding down, she sort of did the opposite. She built this house, which was the sort of house she'd always wanted to build. And it was very much about her. It's a very personal house. It's a sort of celebration of self, I think, of her progress and her triumph.
Well, as you say as well, she scribbled her name effectively all over
yes.
it. You can see her initials
yes.
in the parapets, in the walls and things.
Yes.
Is the architecture of Hardwick, is it remarkable anyway for its time?
Well, I think there were certain things I think Bess liked in buildings, and one of them was light. She liked light. She liked big windows. But glass was also a great feature of Elizabethan, of prodigy houses and lantern houses, they were called, houses that had these huge windows. And because it was glass was expensive, it was a status thing. And so if you could afford to have big windows, you know, you did. And Hardwick, there were other houses that had enormous windows, like Leicester's, Kenilworth in Leicestershire. But Hardwick, I think, had probably bigger windows than anyone else. And, you know, the Tudor builders were competitive. They wanted to build a sort of bigger, better, more astonishing house. And so she liked light. I think she liked height. All her houses were tall houses with the rooms, as the stories rose, the ceilings grew higher. So the rooms on the top floor of her houses, the state rooms, which were for entertaining, had these enormous ceilings, which were extremely impractical, you know, extremely cold, but very spectacular. And you would sort of walk up through the house and you'd emerge on the top floor in these gigantic sort of cathedral-like rooms. But I think Hardwick is in many ways it's oddly modern, I think. If you look at it, it's got a rather sort of simple but very ingenious design. And she employed for Hardwick, she employed the services of Robert Smithson, who was an architect, or at least the sort of nearest thing Tudor England had to an architect. And he had designed several other houses, like he'd worked on Longleat, he'd designed Woolerton in Nottingham, he'd designed a great house called Worksop, which belonged to Bess's fourth husband, the Earl of Shrewsbury. And Bess knew about him, and she clearly wanted she wanted to sort of build an architecturally perfect house, and so she sort of knew that she sort of needed a designer. She needed someone to draw up a plan. So she employed Smithson to do that. And so the sort of ingeniousness of the design of Hardwick, the way the kind of towers are kind of grafted onto the house, and I think is largely due to him. But she also had quite an input in the design of the house and changed it as it was during the 7 years it was built. Various changes were made to the original design, which were probably partly instigated or certainly approved by Bess.
So you've mentioned already that she amassed this great wealth over the course of her life. She's not exactly got a rags to riches tale, but she definitely started from humble beginnings.
Yes.
She ended up the Dowager Countess. How much of her rise was down to her as a person, and how much was she a shrewd businesswoman, is what I'm asking, or is she just found herself in a fortunate place?
No, I think she was a very sort of canny businesswoman, and she certainly, her wealth partly came from her marriages, in that every time her husbands all died, and which is why she kept on marrying. But in Tudor England, on the death of, as a widow, you inherited one third of your husband's wealth, or the income from one third of his estates, so for your lifetime. So she had these inheritances, which gave her a kind of core of money on which to use. But I think the point is about Bess is she didn't simply marry well and therefore become rich. She used the sort of assets and the money that her husband's brought her, and she built on them. So she had money that came via her husband's, but then she used that money to buy more land, lots of, you know, properties, and she used it to sort of invest in businesses like coal mines and lead mines. And so she sort of used what she inherited and built on it. Mm-hmm. So I think she had a very sort of lucrative sideline in lending money. A lot of, you know, a lot of Tudor's cash was in short supply, and Bess had large amounts of cash, which she was happy to lend on the security of land. And so when people, whoever was borrowing money, they didn't repay their loans, then the land would come to her. So she sort of kept increasing her estates. That was another way she kept amassing more land, was through creditors who failed to repay their loans.
I know that we can't know exactly what her personality was like, but was she harsh at all?
I think she was someone
who hadn't paid their debts?
Well, she was tough. I think she was, you know, she was definitely tough and ambitious. She didn't sort of, you know, she wasn't very sympathetic necessarily. She was quite hard on her children. She certainly didn't, you know, if you didn't repay your debts, I don't think you were given much sort of leeway. Mm-hmm. And so I think she was, you know, she could be affectionate and she was rather sentimental. But I think primarily, I think she was ambitious and tough, and she was a force and determined.
You've mentioned already that, well, women in the 16th century had few opportunities to improve their position except through marriage, which is how Bess, you know, the foundations of her money were built on her marriages. She married four times. Perhaps you could take us through each of these relationships for our listeners who perhaps don't know, starting right at the beginning with her first marriage, just to give a bit of a narrative.
Sure. Well, her first marriage was to a Derbyshire boy called Robert Barley, who was younger than her. She was about 21. He was probably only about 13 or 14. And it was very short-lived. He died after, I think, only about a year of marriage, and it was probably unconsummated because of his age. Mm-hmm. So it was, no one knows that for sure. So that was a brief marriage, which nevertheless she left her with a small, she had her widow's jointure, which was only about £26, but it was something, gave her a small amount of money. And her next husband, who was key, was William Cavendish, who she met probably through the Marquess of Dorset and his wife, Frances Grey. And William Cavendish was also, like Bess, from the gentry, but he, through the dissolution, he was a commissioner during the dissolution, and he'd accrued a lot of land and money through that. So he was a rich man, and he was also, he had a court position, so he was at court. So William Cavendish took sort of Bess out of Derbyshire and took her to London and to court, where she met various courtiers.
She became in Elizabeth I's court.
Yes. Yeah. So she knew the met the Queen and was on sort of, you know, friendly, cordial terms. and with William Cavendish, they bought Chatsworth together, which was in Derbyshire, which was almost certainly at Bess's instigation, because William Cavendish had no links to Derbyshire himself. They had six children, and then he died, if William Cavendish was probably the husband she loved, if she loved any of her husbands. So he died, leaving her with six young children. And she then married someone called William St. Low, who was also a courtier and was also rich. And he had great estates in the West Country. And he was extremely doting, but she was, I think, rather less enamoured. And he spent a lot of time at court, at Queen Elizabeth's court. Bess actually spent most of her time in Derbyshire building Chatsworth, the Elizabethan Chatsworth. And William St. Low also died, and quite suddenly. And then,
suspicious all these days.
Well, it does sound suspicious, but I think actually natural causes. But and then her fourth and final husband was the grandest of all, and that was George Talbot, Earl of Shrewsbury, who was a sort of Midlands tycoon, and who was richer than any of them, and he had vast amounts of land throughout the Midlands. And a lot of iron works and lead mines, and so he was one of the kind of England's premier earls. Mm-hmm. So then she became Countess of Shrewsbury. So that was her grandest marriage, but it was also a marriage that sort of broke down in a great deal of rancour and bitterness in the end.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that Bess ended up at court. So I think this was at the age of 31. Was it through her third husband or her second husband?
Well, through William Cavendish, she spent time at court because he had a court position. So she wasn't living at court, but she mm-hmm. was in London. She would definitely have attended court, and they made prince. Well, as she was then, Princess Elizabeth, later Queen Elizabeth, was godmother to one of their sons. So they were, you know, they were on some friendly terms with the Queen.
Well, this is what I wanted to ask you about her relationship with Elizabeth I. Was it always friendly, or were there tensions? Elizabeth I obviously being a very, strong-willed.
Yes,
well,
they were both.
Yeah,
they were two strong-willed, but they had some similarities and also many differences. And I think they were on fairly friendly terms. I mean, as far as the Queen, I mean, she was a queen; she didn't really have friends. But they were on some good terms most of the time. Bess was very good about things like present giving. She was at the Tudors gave presents at New Year, not at Christmas, and the Queen, it was important, your New Year's gift to the Queen was kind of important, had to be given, you know, thought had to be, trouble had to be taken. And particularly, she was very keen on being given sort of gifts of clothing, really, you know, serious, fancy frocks.
Clothes, yeah.
Yes, so Bess, you know, would kind of present her with these very finely embroidered dresses and cloaks and such things. So they were on fairly good terms. They were on rather less good terms when a bit later on Bess had hopes that her granddaughter, who was called Arbella Stuart, who had royal blood. So Elizabeth didn't have an heir. So there was a constant sort of uncertainty and speculation about who would be the next monarch. And Bess's granddaughter had a claim. And Bess, I think, certainly hoped for some time that Arbella might, in fact, become queen. But this was not something that Queen Elizabeth was favoured in any way, was not willing to countenance. And so I think Bess's sort of ambitions for her granddaughter definitely caused a bit of strain.
Do we have evidence of this sort of ambitions she had? Did she want her granddaughter to succeed the throne?
I think she did. I mean, she was a schemer, and it's hard to know from you know all yeah. the so many
yeah, yeah, the
so,
evidence
yeah the evidence for it. But She did, and she wrote letters, and she had engineered the marriage between Arbella's mother, who was her youngest daughter Elizabeth, actually mm-hmm. her second youngest daughter, and the man she married, Charles Stuart, and that was definitely Bess's doing, and it was a way of she was trying to marry her daughter to somebody who had royal blood.
Mm-hmm. And she had those ambitions.
Yes, yeah. And she did that without getting royal permission. So that caused...
Oh, Elizabeth yes. wouldn't have been happy.
No.
So I also wanted to ask about her relationship with Mary, Queen of Scots, because I think when she was married to George yeah. Talbot, Earl of Shrewsbury,
yes.
He was one of the richest and... He was a very wealthy and powerful man.
Yes.
And he was appointed keeper of Mary, Queen of Scots. What can you tell us about Bess's relationship with Mary? How closely would they have come into contact with each other?
Well, quite close contact because the Earl of Shrewsbury was effectively Mary's jailer, which meant that he kept Mary in his... He shunted Mary about from house to house. He had various properties, large houses in the Midlands, which was partly why he was chosen as her jailer, because the Midlands was thought to be secure. It was a long way from London. It wasn't near any mm-hmm. ports or too near Scotland. And so Mary was living with the Shrewsburys, I mean, for 15 years. And in the early days, Bess saw quite a lot of Mary because they were under the same roof and they spent quite a lot of time doing embroidery together, which was one of Mary's great loves, and also one of Bess's kind of also they shared a love mm-hmm. for embroidery. Mary was a very sort of fine needlewoman, so they definitely spent in early on a lot of time sitting gossiping and embroidering. But then Bess, I think, became increasingly fed up with Mary and spent less and less. She would just take herself off to another house, leaving Mary and Shrewsbury. And she also then she sort of fell out with Mary because Bess had her own ambitions for her granddaughter, and mm-hmm. and that caused tensions, and it ended up they were not on good terms at all, and they both actually tried to sort of make trouble for each other, and Mary wrote letters kind of trying to sort of defame Bess. And so there were rumours that Shrewsbury actually had an affair with Mary, that she was his mistress, that they'd even had a child. Which
was this a rumour that Bess started?
Possibly. I mean, that was one of those. Shrewsbury blamed Bess and her sons for these rumours, and Bess, they denied it. It's impossible to really know where their rumours came yeah. from, or even if there was anything behind them. There probably wasn't, but but you know, Bess may well have been jealous of Mary. Mary was younger, and she was famously attractive and mm-hmm. and charming, and she was very good at sort of winning people over and winning sympathy, and the Shrewsbury, the servants, Bess and Shrewsbury's servants, were Mary was frequently kind of conscripting the servants and persuading them to carry secret messages and letters for her. So she was obviously, she was manipulative. So there was this sort of rather manipulative, very attractive woman who was the sort of third person in the marriage, really. And so it was sort of inevitably, it did cause trouble.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
And if we just go back to the talking about Bess and her building.
Yes.
Where do you think Bess's passion for these lavish building projects came from? Why do you think she was interested in developing properties?
Well, it's very hard, you know, it's really hard to know that. I mean, I think it was partly ambition and competitiveness. She wanted, you know, she saw these great houses going up like Longleat and Burley House, Holdenby, which was a house in Northamptonshire. I think she wanted to make her mark. She wanted to leave something, a sort of legacy in stone. I think she genuinely actually was interested in architecture and the process of building. She didn't need to build four houses. No, I mean, yeah. She had plenty of houses, and Shrewsbury had plenty of houses. So between them, she was very well housed. So I think she wasn't especially cultured, but she certainly wasn't. She hadn't been educated, sort of culturally. But I think she had a aesthetic interest, and I think she was interested in how things looked. And she was interested in the furnishing of her houses, and she took a lot of trouble commissioning textiles and so on and buying furnishings. And so I think it was partly just she was just building the spirit of the times, because she was keeping up with the other, you know, they were male, but sort of other.
Do you think that powerful might have been a part male of it? She
figures.
Looked around her and was like, these
I think
powerful
so.
Male
yes,
figures.
Yes, I think
doing
she
this.
Thought, I can do this too, and I'm going to, you know, I can play this game too, and I can build a kind of bigger, better, or more, you know, extraordinary house.
Did the houses she was involved with shape our architectural history? Did they have a legacy? Can you find examples of things she did in her buildings that have carried on through the centuries at all?
Well, I think you can. I mean, in some ways, I think actually Hardwick has, it's not the sort of the tall towers with the windows. There's something almost a bit, they're sort of like, they're almost like mini skyscrapers. Quite a modern house, I think, in lots of ways. And there's definitely architects have taken inspiration from Hardwick, like the designers of the Walsall Art Gallery, who are called Caruso St. John. They were inspired by Hardwick, and the way they're inspired by Hardwick is they have, the Walsall Art Gallery has the room with the higher ceiling is on the top floor. So you sort of wind your way through the gallery in the same way that you wind yourself your way through Hardwick up these sort of winding stone stairs. And then you emerge into this great room with, you know, very high ceilings, much higher than the stories below. So I think it has been, I think it has inspired and does inspire architects.
And just as we're nearing the end, I was wondering if you could tell, so if our listeners want to go and see some of the places that Bess was involved with building, obviously Hardwick's the only completely remaining
Yes.
Once. So Chatsworth was torn down and rebuilt, was it?
Chatsworth, yes. Yeah. In the 17th century, Chatsworth was pulled down. Mm-hmm. But so that's completely
vanished.
And is
there can you see no touch of Bess's work there anymore at all?
Not really. I mean, except in the way that the sort of actual configuration of the house, it's built on exactly the same site. It's roughly, I think, roughly the same size. Big. Yeah. And it also actually, in the sort of the way the interiors are configured and with actually this, the high ceilings being on the upper floors. So there are sort of traces. There mm-hmm. are some traces of the Elizabethan house. I think the cellars are still there. There's a turret in the grounds called the Hunting Tower, which was from Bess's day. There's little that's left. I mean, at Hardwick, there's the new hall and there's also the old hall, which is next door to the new hall and is now a ruin. I mean, so she built the old hall before she built the new hall. So she sort of effectively, she built two houses right next door to each other. And the old hall was enormous. So she didn't, but it was architecturally a bit of a, it was confused and so incoherent and not satisfactory.
Do you think this is why she built the second property?
Yes.
So she always had her first draft.
Exactly. It was a sort of rehearsal. And it was, you know, it was had very two sets of very grand state rooms, and it was certainly sort of big enough for her. But it wasn't the house she really wanted. It was a sort of imperfect house. So I think she sort of put that aside and then she built the new one, and that was the house that she'd sort of always wanted to build. And so the old hall is you can visit it, but you can get a sense of how it was, but it's a ruin today.
So for people who are going to visit Hardwick, what should they be looking out for, in your opinion? What should they take note of?
Well, I think they should take note of the way you're led through the house, and the way that the drama of the state rooms, the long gallery and the high great chamber. The high great chamber has this sort of extraordinary plasterwork frieze showing sort of forest scenes, because of painted plasterwork. And it's a completely sort of astonishing room. And it's also, I mean, Hardwick has almost, I think, the best collection of sort of 16th century textiles and embroideries, which are all still there, and mostly, well, not all on display, but a lot of them are on display, and some of them are you know, hardly even faded from Bess's day, and they're things that she either bought or worked on herself with her ladies, and so there's a, you know, very fine collection of textiles. But the house itself it's got sort of great sort of drama and romance to it.
And one final question, actually. I was going to ask you about just how do you build a house in Tudor England? This is a huge question, but obviously today we'd have planning permission, we'd have architects, we'd have all this. What was what happened in, Elizabethan England? How do you go about building a house?
Well, obviously you didn't need planning permission.
No.
But you might have got a plan, some kind of basic plan, and as Bess did for Hardwick. Although architects didn't really exist in 16th century England, there were definitely people who could draw plans. Usually they were masons who could produce architectural drawings. So ideally, I think you would have got some sort of plan, and then you would have set about sort of assembling your materials. And for Bess, that was relatively easy because she had land and estates, and she could provide most of her materials herself. All the stone, she had quarries, all the timber, she had lead, so she could have lead for the windows. She had her own glassworks, which produced glass. But the sort of the key, I think the key thing for 16th century houses was having good craftsmen and the right craftsmen. And although it was quite easy to find labourers to just do the hard labour, they could just be employed locally. Finding really skilled craftsmen, especially plasterers and masons, was harder, because they were in short supply and they were sort of in demand, and you know, great patrons would sort of fight over the best craftsmen. So by the time Bess built Hardwick, she was quite an experienced builder, and so she'd come across craftsmen during her sort of years of building. So she then made sure she had a sort of good team of people, and who, you know, would stay for, I mean, Hardwick took about 7 years to build. So craftsmen would stay and and are sometimes the best, the most skilled would be given a house or a room mm-hmm. and, you know, lodging and would be sort of permanently employed. But really, I think 16th century houses, they were a collaboration on the whole between the patron and the craftsman and as well as perhaps someone who'd drawn up a kind of original plan. But the architect, if that's not even quite the right term, but the drawer up of the plan wouldn't necessarily have been involved in the actual building of the house. So that was really down to the patron and the craftsman between them. They would kind of direct.
Yeah, a collaborative.
Yes, it was collaborative.
Great. Well, I think that's probably all we've got time for today. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on our podcast.
Thank you.
That was Kate Hubbard. Devices and Desires, Bess of Hardwick and the Building of Elizabethan England is out now in the UK, published by Chatto and Windus. And in the US, it's due out in February, published by Harper. And you can read a review of the book in the January 19 issue of BBC History magazine, which goes on sale on the 27th of December. Meanwhile, you might also be interested in our special edition, The Story of Medicine, which has just been reprinted following popular demand. It will be available in several retailers and can also be ordered directly from us via buysubscriptions.com/medicine2018. And that is about all for this episode, but we will return on Monday with our annual Christmas history quiz.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com. And we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.